Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. The Huntsville Unit, the oldest prison in the state of Texas, is notorious for its execution chamber, the most active chamber in the United States. 585 executions have been carried out there since 1982. Tack on another 755 dating all the way back to when its doors first opened in 1819 for a total of 1,340 executed prisoners in its history. They started by hanging, then moved on to the electric chair before finally settling on lethal injection. And for those men and women, sorry ladies, there were 9 of you represented in that total, for those executed and left an unclaimed corpse, there is a burial ground. It's nicknamed Peckerwood Hill. Peckerwood being a derogatory term for poor whites from rural areas. The name kind of comes from them, most of the men being buried there having resembled woodpeckers with their straight, strong backs from hard labor and their often greasy hair standing on end like alfalfa's, that little rascal from TV. The Huntsville unit saw many a Peckerwood swing in the early days, sizzle in its heyday, along with blacks and Hispanics and, you know, any other race, of course. There's no discrimination here. Well, actually, there's nothing but discrimination here. It's a prison, after all. Prisons are the most discriminatory places on earth. A bunch of real, like, low-level thinking when it comes to how we decipher who we should hang out with. It comes right down to race, but I digress. Peckerwood Hill is where I walk for today's episode. I'm simply looking for something new to talk about. A dark topic that hasn't been scavenged and used up by the countless crime shows out there these days. I'm thinking that maybe there's something here on Peckerwood Hill. Maybe there's a lot here. Every graveyard is filled with secrets. The oldest prison graveyard in America must have something worth digging up. And I'm correct, of course. In fact, I'm shocked by the stones I can clearly read, those dating back to the early 80s. I'm surprised that I don't recognize even one of these names. Oh, but wait, there's David Lee Spence of the Lake Waco murders. And now we're cooking. Here's Kenneth McDuff, whom I covered in episode 29 of Dark Topic, The Broomstick Killer. But truly, as I look around, I don't see a lot of names here or any that the true crime consumer, let alone the general population, would immediately recognize or recall. So let's just pick one, shall we? Let me just take a few more steps, dig in with my shovel, and see what kind of trouble we can get into. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. A random killer. Michael Lee Lockhart was born on September the 30th of 1960 in Wallbridge, Ohio. He was sentenced to death via lethal injection on December 9th of 1997, I read here. And as I go back and research on my iPhone in the corner of this graveyard, I find his last words, quote, "A lot of people view what is happening here as evil, but I want you to know that I found love and compassion here. The people who work here, I thank them for the kindness they have shown me, and I deeply appreciate all that has been done for me by the people who work here. That's all, Warden. I'm ready." End quote. Well, that's nice. Those are fond words by Lockhart about the Huntsville unit. But let's not get too mushy. I'm sure he can't be all that sweet, considering where he was laid to rot. Speaking of mushy and sweet, what was his last meal? Just out of curiosity before we keep digging here. And oh yeah, it's a classic. A double patty cheeseburger, French fries, and a Coke. Beautiful. Beautiful choice. You know, don't get too fancy about it. Just have what's nostalgic to you, what tastes good, and, you know, go get your shot. It doesn't get any more American, any more wholesome than what we got here so far on this random killer. I got a good feeling about this one. I'm assuming he killed. That's a prerequisite for acceptance to be buried on Peckerwood Hill. He's a Peckerwood, that's for sure. Born in small town Ohio, there's no doubt that Michael Lee Lockhart grew up white trash. The 9th of 10 kids, he'd later describe his childhood as having been terrible. Molested twice by two different men at the age of 6, from the age of 6 to 8, I believe. And this changed young Michael in ways he later realized as detrimental to his mindset and thinking patterns going forward. A head injury while playing football didn't help much. Neither did teasing from his peers all through school years that only stopped when he dropped out early. He was teased, I believe, because Michael Lee Lockhart was a poor kid from a shit town, a shit family, and could look forward to nothing but a shit life. Lucky for him, he had decent looks and never had much trouble with women as he slowly began to move away from his hometown, where he was seen as kind of like a little weasel, you know, a little dirt squirrel, a kid that would just, you know, steal your mom's purse when you invited him over, who would dip his fingers into the pie that's on the sill, say, who would try to dip those same sticky fingers into your sister. He joined the army and was stationed in South Korea. This military career was short-lived, and he received a general discharge only a year and a half in to this military career as a combat engineer. He was a thief, a sociopath, and nobody from home wanted much to do with him. By the time he reached early adulthood, and by the time he got back from this short stint in the military, he did get married when he got back to an Ohio girl from Toledo, I believe. They had a daughter together. But in August of 1984, in his mid-20s, something snapped. Lockhart visited a suicide prevention center in Toledo, saying he'd been having suicidal thoughts and that his drug and alcohol use was out of hand. He's placed in a psychiatric hospital for treatment, but his family soon convinced him to leave that center. It's one of those situations where everyone feels uncomfortable with his struggles as they may reflect on them somehow. This is a loser culture, a trash culture. I've been around it a bit. And Lockhart returns to life still uneasy with himself, though it brings relief to everyone else that he's out of the psych ward and people can stop whispering about, you know, what the rest of them might have going on wrong with them. Michael's fine. We're all fine. Everything's fine, but it of course isn't. Lockhart had completed a questionnaire upon admission to the psych ward. When asked what he feared most, his answer was, quote, hurting someone else. It would take until that autumn for him to give up the charade as a family man and disappear. On October 11th, 1984, Lockhart drove his wife to work in his parents' car, quit his truck driving job, then drove away. Off to get cigarettes, you know, that whole thing. Men like this, they get involved with a woman, they have the child, they think they're doing everything right, and then as soon as things get tough, they gotta go get a pack of smokes. There's little information on what Michael Lockhart got up to until 1988, but it's been reported that he may have been responsible for over 20 bank and store robberies across the South. For certain, he performed a stick-up at a Baton Rouge bank in mid-March of 88. A marked banknote would later be proved to have been used by Lockhart for a cab ride to Houston, but I'm getting way ahead of myself. I don't even know why I have that written down. We will get to that eventually. There are plenty of robberies that could be proven to be attributed to him, but there's little information on them considering what his larger crimes are later on. It kind of overshadowed them. And there's little information on this case in general. I just stumbled across it walking through this graveyard on Peckerwood Hill. Can we smoke out here? Well, looks like we're doing it. I know that he robbed a gas station in Wyoming and was caught. He spent some time in prison. From what I could tell, he mainly used up women, gaining their trust, charming them, betting them, before robbing them. I'm not satisfied with the thin research here, but I share what little I found as a way to fill in the 4-year gap after he left his family in the lurch. And men like this, when they leave their families, actually, often they don't leave their family in the lurch. They're doing them a favor. They weren't that great in the first place, so it's a bit of a relief for them to have gone. From my understanding, Lockhart left his wife, stole his parents' car, and went on a plotting 4-year crime spree that fueled his alcohol and cocaine addiction and kept him busy until one day, Lockhart again seemed to snap. He was laying in an Indiana motel bed, hungover and jittery from his drug use. The date was October 13th, 1987. Lockhart would later recall his feelings that morning, quote, "My first thought was that this is a perfect day to die. I was suicidal. And if I was going to die, then I was going to kill somebody too." End quote. The previous day, he'd robbed and assaulted a woman in Chicago about an hour and a half away. He still had her purse and the stolen blue Toyota Celica parked out front of his sleazy Indiana motel room. This car he pilfered from a woman in Atlanta, along with $300 worth of jewelry. The car type, however, I'm not 100% certain on. Conflicting research shows that Lockhart was earlier arrested for the blue Toyota theft. Celica, probably fucked that name up, Celica. In this story, Lockhart had verbally abused the arresting officer and threatened to kill the woman he'd robbed. Later, he apparently stole a red Corvette at gunpoint from a car salesman. This Corvette is what may be parked out in front of the Indiana Motel, though I'm not sure. Because the dates surrounding his thefts are reported differently in separate documents, I get hung up on cars. I just want you to see the type of car he's driving for some reason all the time. So it's either a red Corvette or a small blue Toyota car. It seems that Lockhart was involved in so much random crime across so many states that it's a challenge to keep it all straight. And that's the nature of men like Lockhart. They create chaos. Just when you think you've got a good idea what they're all about, they pull some stunt that makes you forget all of the previous transgressions. Then they disappear. Then they reappear, claiming to have changed. Seem to have changed before the change in the console of your vehicle goes missing, than the vehicle itself. And that's just Michael. What a rascal. You know, a real little stinker. Michael Lockhart got around, and he's difficult to keep track of leading to the events forthcoming. He reminds me of my father. And Dark Topic listeners, those of you here on Patreon, Apple Plus, will know that I had a conversation with Kent talking about how I would at some point try to contact my father. I did try at Christmas, and I think he's gone. I don't know where he is. Nobody knows where he is. And that's the way with men like this. I'm sure one day he'll show up at my door, or I'll get a message that he's gone. But after so long with these types, and you have so many distrustful interactions where you're built up, they build themselves up, they build up your trust in them, and then they tear it all away, you have to remove yourself and just, I guess, wait for the next encounter and see if they handle it differently, and certainly make sure that you protect yourself from them. And when you start to protect yourself from them, they stop showing up so much because they know that they can't bleed you dry anymore. He was like my father, coasting constantly, avoiding responsibilities, seeking quick thrills, charming, fun, and up for anything, including the theft of your wallet at 5 a.m. after having shown up at your door the night before with his tail tucked between his legs, claiming to need a place to crash after somebody screwed him. You know, and when in reality he's just looking to not crash, but to cash in on you and use that cashing in for more drugs and booze and just selfish living. But Michael Lee Lockhart does something now that's out of character for such types. He doesn't cry about his predicament. He doesn't beg anybody for help. He doesn't turn back to a bottle or a drug or a small score. He instead says to himself, am I going to die? Should I kill myself? Or should I just become a completely different type of animal? That's what he does. He becomes a completely different type of animal. He's empowered by the notion that he will kill himself. He decides to do whatever he wants as a result of truly feeling like this is what he's going to do to himself. So he will just let it ride. You know, there's a relief there. People who are going to commit suicide, from what I've learned, often feel a big relief in knowing that they're going to go. In this situation, normally people are much nicer to others, and maybe they try to make up for some of the things that they've done. In this circumstance, when it comes to Michael Lee Lockhart, he decides, I'm going to kill as many as I can until I'm caught or killed. It's evil. Lockhart becomes a random killer. He says to himself, hey, screw it. If I'm ready to die, let's see how many I can take down with me. And as derisive, low-down, filthy, dirty, self-serving pieces of shit like him say, when it comes to that type of thinking, that's the spirit. The decided killer leaves the motel and gets into what I now believe was his stolen red Corvette and sets to stalking Griffith, Indiana for the perfect victim. It's a town of about 16,000 people. He's decided it will be a young woman, a teenager. So he begins looking for a high school. 16-year-old Wendy Gallagher is the unfortunate girl to be spotted walking home, entering an apartment where her mother and younger sister live as well. It's not clear how Lockhart deduces she will be alone for a while, but she is set to be the only one in the place until 5:30 p.m. He has about 2 hours to work with here. Her mother works late, her sister is busy with extracurricular activities until dinner. There is no more perfect a situation for what he plans to do, and I have to surmise he had spent some time scoping the situation in the days previous. If not, then I hate to say it, as I'm sure I've used this line before, but something must have been looking out for her killer this day. I don't really believe that. I also don't believe things happen for a reason in the positive sense. It's just sometimes coincidence sure can make God feel close, and other times, the devil. Lockhart closes in. He knocks on the door. Wendy answers. She's a sweet young woman and doesn't hesitate to allow her killer in to use the phone. Just after 5:30 p.m., Wendy's younger sister Christine arrives home from swim practice. Mom will be home around 10:30 tonight. She's working. Christine heats a frozen pizza in the oven and sits down to enjoy it while watching TV. It's not until an hour or so later that she'll go to Wendy's room to say hello. But this hello turns out to be a gruesome goodbye. All right, Rosetta Stone, everybody. If you want to learn a new language naturally, speak it confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the way you learned your first. Through real-world context and conversation, no memorization, just practical skills you can use right away. Rosetta Stone is a leading language learning program available on desktop and mobile, designed to fully immerse you in your chosen language for a more natural and effective learning experience. I've used Rosetta Stone. I'm using it right now to learn English as I stumble through this ad read. No, I've been trying to learn Japanese. I want to do that trip that I've been talking about, and I continue to learn through Rosetta Stone, and I find it to be a very enjoyable experience, easy way to go about learning. My favorite feature so far has been the built-in true accent. Speech recognition technology provides real-time feedback, helping you sound more natural. There's nothing that I fear more than people not thinking I'm actually Japanese in Japan. Now, I do enjoy knowing how close I am getting to the way it's supposed to be actually spoken. It's like having a personal language coach guiding you through your accent every step of the way. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Wendy lays in bed, partially nude, naked from the waist down, bra pushed up over her breasts. Her hands are bound behind her back, In her mouth is a gag. She has been stabbed 21 times with a large knife. 17 wounds are to the abdomen, 4 to the throat. The dead girl has been raped, and her death had come from either having her stomach cut open and her intestines spilled, or the vicious wounds in her neck, or both. Disemboweled will be the word on the coroner's report. It is a vicious murder and a shocking crime scene. A palm print will be lifted from a blood-spattered wall of the teen's room. More prints will be lifted from a glass of water. Thirsty work. The killer had leaned against a wall and downed the girl's bedside drink after he had bound, raped, tortured, and eviscerated her before leaving. Lockhart had stolen Wendy's purse along with a small photo of her and nearly missed having a go at her younger sister when she returned home probably about half an hour later. Bloodstains on a curtain indicate that the killer had checked the girl's window throughout the torture. Wendy's window. Lucky for his sister, he had finished before she returned. Back in his stolen vehicle, he takes the cash, then stuffs Wendy's purse into the larger one he'd stolen in Chicago days earlier. And I have to say, her name is Wendy. It's not Wendy, and I'm not mixing up Wendy because I'm talking about Chicago. Just so you know. Her name is Wendy. I like the name. So stuffing her purse into the previous victim's purse from Chicago is a connection that will later doom him, as the surviving Chicago victim will later positively identify Lockhart when her purse is discovered ditched and her ID is still in it. Wendy's ID was not in her purse, but they deduce, they find out. They don't deduce. I mean, they just look at it and they show it to the family and they're like, yeah, that's hers. That's inside that. Once the purse is returned to this Chicago victim, sorry, it's getting a little confusing here. It's mainly my writing here. And he's just simply not trying very hard to hide any of this. This Chicago victim who was victimized a couple of days before this murder is able to later identify Lockhart by looking at a picture of him. She provided a sketch of him as well, just so you know what he looks like. They describe him as handsome. I don't find him so, you know, for many reasons. You know. But he has a mustache. He is a lot in the same vein as maybe a Bundy, where you could see it in their eyes that they probably would be able to charm women. These types are so overconfident in themselves that it makes up for a lot of things to do with them that should be unattractive. I mean, you can overwhelm somebody with confidence. I've met a lot of people who aren't that great looking, including myself, that can win people over through confidence alone. There was a lot of evidence that was kind of piling up here. There's the prints left at this crime scene. There are eyewitness accounts of his stolen vehicle in the area of this crime and others. It was only a matter of time before he'd be caught. He's not being too careful. This is, after all, just kind of a bucket list thing for him, it seems, this murder stuff. He has no real plans of actually getting away. In Lockhart's mind, he's already dead. He should have just died in the Indiana motel room that morning. But he kind of made this promise to himself, or came to this epiphany where it was like, well, if I'm going to go, I might as well just be a reaper walking around, taking people down with me. Who gives a fuck? But like it always is with such men, Lockhart soon cheers up. He no longer feels suicidal after his Griffith, Indiana day trip that ended with a 16-year-old girl split in half, hogtied, gagged, and blankly staring at the posters on her walls. Her sister screams, then later her mother's, trying to reach her as the crime scene is dissected. A fresh bag of cocaine and a case of beer after a hard day's work sure can go a long way to pick up such a man's spirits. Michael Lockhart is refreshed by the mayhem he caused. Dealing death has brought him back to life, it seems. He skips town, leaving Griffith, Indiana detectives shell-shocked. They've never handled a crime of this magnitude. You could see some of their interviews. There was an episode of Real Detectives where there's a couple of the detectives that they interview, and I hate to be rude, but they don't seem very bright. It's not that they don't seem very bright. It's that they've just never dealt with anything like this before. And even in retelling the story, they're still flabbergasted, you know? And they've never seen anything like this, and they will never see anything like it again. The Wendy Gallagher murder destroys the sense of safety previously enjoyed in Griffith, Indiana. The style of killing is very Bundy-esque and sends whispers through the community of a serial killer being responsible, which isn't quite true yet. Like I said, Lockhart is in a good mood now. He puts Ohio plates on his stolen vehicle. He's got plates from many states. It helps to blend his stolen vehicles in. By this point, I'm certain he's now driving a red Corvette. He likes to keep a high profile. The killer heads home to see his wife and daughter. It's time. The half a decade he's been gone has been good for him in this matter, the matter of being unable or unwilling to man up and be a father, a husband. But when he arrives to the home in Toledo, he's perturbed to find his wife is now his ex-wife, and his daughter doesn't care much to know him. He charms his ex-wife and sends the daughter off for the weekend to grandparents, I believe. But then the real Michael Lockhart comes out, and he spends the weekend terrorizing his ex, strapping her to a chair, a bed, raping her, abusing her, before taking off again the Monday morning of November 9th, 1987. It's too cold here. Frigid. Though he thawed that bitch, showed her. Fuck this place. Lockhart steals some food from his little girl's mouth in the form of cash and valuables, then heads south for the winter. Crime continued to pay. Lockhart robs a Payless shoe store in Jacksonville. He had a gun, a .357 Magnum he'd stolen from a home. It was a cop's gun, actually. And he starts robbing more banks, gas stations, unsuspecting women. And now he's robbing just retail stores. He'll walk into a place and decide, hey, you know what? Maybe I'll just rob this fucking place. He's out of control. And on this early morning of January 20th, 1988, in Land O'Lakes, Florida, Lockhart again wakes up feeling low in a seedy motel room. But now he has a cure-all. He would later recall of this gloomy morning that his first thought was not suicide as it previously would have been. His thought was, quote, I gotta go out and get me one. Now, before we follow Lockhart out to get one, I should mention that he is suspected of having killed more girls. How many, we'll likely never know, but in the summer of 1987, so a year previous, 16-year-old Kathy Hobbs went missing while on a late-night walk to the store in her Las Vegas suburb. She never returned home and was soon discovered after her vanishing in the desert, having been raped and brutally murdered after having been abducted. Sources say that a rock was used to bludgeon her to death. Many believed Lockhart to be responsible later. He apparently was in the area at the time of the Kathy Hobbs murder. This case was high profile, featured on Unsolved Mysteries, as there was a strange twist to Kathy's story. Apparently she'd had a premonition of her death, many premonitions of death, since she was a little kid. She was certain she wouldn't live past 16. This went on for, you know, from the age of, I think, 5 years old. She talked about how she wouldn't live past the age of 16, wrote about it, drew pictures about it, freaked everybody out. In fact, she'd gone so far as to write goodbye letters to her loved ones and was shocked when she woke up alive on her 16th birthday. Kathy had been certain that a man with a mustache would steal her away. It was downright eerie how much she talked about it, as if it were a foregone conclusion. 3 months into her 16th year, perhaps the mustachioed Michael Lockhart showed up after all. She was his type. He did later claim to have killed in Nevada, among other states. And that's just a creepy little side road. The mother, you know I love this shit. But Unsolved Mysteries really grabbed onto it because of all the premonition aspect to it. And the mother recalled waking up in the middle of the night that night that her daughter went missing and feeling relief and saying to herself, at least it's over. And maybe that was around the time her daughter died. I don't know. It's creepy Unsolved Mysteries shit. But that's just a creepy little side road. Let's get back to proven ground. A school bus drops a 14-year-old girl off in Land O'Lakes, Florida, and a red Corvette will be spotted rolling through soon after. Again, let me get to you the date for that because I just kind of went out of track there. This is now January 20th of 1988, a few months past his previous killing in October of Wendy Gallagher. The girl's name has been changed in a few sources I found, so I'll refrain from sharing it myself. My thinking is that the family requested anonymity at some point. I'll tell you that her first name is Lindsay, for at least some connection here. We've all met a 14-year-old girl named Lindsay, I think. Lockhart followed her home, knocked on the door, confirmed through conversation that the girl was alone, then asked to use the phone, as he did with the Wendy Gallagher case. Michael Lockhart was at one time a door-to-door salesman. That is why he's so comfortable approaching homes. He'd learned during his time as a door-to-door salesman that not many people pay much attention to a door-to-door salesman after he's hit a few places on the block. BTK did this at one point, but he was pretending to be a security expert, which he, in a way, well, he was, right? He was. That's scary to me. I've always found that frightening because I did door-to-door sales, and I was always amazed by how easy it was to walk up to a door, disappear behind the trees, you know, get up onto the porch, knock, hear nothing, and it's just me in the house. Back then, right? Nowadays we have Ring and all that shit, and people are maybe a little bit more suspicious, but back then it wasn't that unusual to see a man walking door to door. He probably did this many times, walking up to doors in pursuit of prime situation. And these are two of the times in which it landed perfectly for him. We're obviously only privy to the few times it worked out and the few times in which he was tied to the case. This one went like the last, almost exactly. 14-year-old Lindsay was discovered by her 8-year-old brother later that day, bound, raped, disemboweled, dead. In my research, I came upon a forum where someone claimed to be a friend of the family, and they shared that in later years, Lindsay's sister would intentionally light her trailer on fire and kill herself as a result of the ensuing pain and grief caused over this grisly murder. True or not, I think it's part of the conversation often overlooked. The fallout from such heinous crimes must be toxic. I can't imagine ever recovering from finding a loved one in the state of which Lockhart was leaving his victims. There's a signature here, the disembowelment of the girls. It's a pretty sick aspect as far as details go for crime scenes. It's thought this was done as the girls still struggled to live. And it's quite clear that in Michael Lockhart, there was a very evil, very deranged spirit now. I think that sometimes in the world of true crime, we begin to blend it all in together. I mean, this case is reminiscent of the previous case that I covered with the guy climbing in through the windows. What the fuck was that case that I just covered? You know, the babysitter killer. Where he found, you know, a prime opportunity and took advantage of it. Raped the girl, bound her, stabbed her. It is reminiscent of it, but, you know, all crime scenes are unique in their own way. Even if in some ways they seem similar. They're all horrifying. They're all inconceivable. Or at least they should be. But after a while, it's easy to just consume another tale like this and think, well, you know, I've heard worse. Well, this sounds like the last one you covered, Jack. Maybe I'll check out the next episode. I just want to pause and recognize how bad this is. Torture, rape, murder aside, he cut these kids open at the belly with their arms tied behind their backs and likely leered at them as they screamed through a gag. And still, I have to read of people against his eventual execution, and then others speaking of how it's a shame such a charming, handsome young man went this way. In this, Lockhart draws parallels to Bundy as well. I've mentioned Bundy twice now, and the reason why is because people draw parallels. They thought he was a budding Bundy. I'm reminded of a detective saying in the case of Bundy that he wished he could drag some of these people to the crime scenes he saw and ask them if he's so pretty now. So charming, so endearing. Now, anyways, back to Lockhart. He's off robbing banks after this second known murder, snorting coke, drinking booze. There are women all along the way. All are left scorned. Not many are left dead, from what we know. But the ones alive, they're left with their purses empty, hearts broken, but lucky to be alive, they'll later realize. It all comes to an end when Lockhart is spotted interacting with a known drug dealer at a basketball court in Beaumont, Texas. The officer is Officer Paul Halsey, 30 years old. When Lockhart leaves with the dealer in his conspicuous red Corvette, Officer Halsey follows. A chase ensues, and Lockhart manages to shake the cop, but later, Officer Halsey spots the Corvette in a motel parking lot and tracks Lockhart to his room. There, he finds the killer and requests to see some identification. Michael Lockhart is upset with this intrusion. He suspects this cop is just playing cowboy and asks to see a search warrant when he's demanded to get his ID and let the cop in. Officer Halsey has good instincts. He calls for backup. He knows something is off with this character. He suspects the Corvette with its Florida plates to be stolen. It's a little odd to have this in a small Texas town talking to drug dealers, you know, a red Corvette with Florida plates. Again, he's really not playing safe here. So when this officer sees a gun on Lockhart's dresser, the small town Texas sheriff pulls his own weapon and forces Michael Lockhart up against a wall of the motel room. Unfortunately, there is a mirror on this wall, and Lockhart observes Officer Halsey lower his weapon to retrieve cuffs. The killer turns and swings, knocking Halsey down onto the bed. Lockhart grabs his own gun, and the officer meets him with his gun. The two fight and struggle, each of their weapons discharging in the battle for control. Officer Halsey bites Lockhart's trigger finger. Lockhart stabs at the officer with a pen. It's a mad scramble. But soon Lockhart has the upper hand and is pointing his weapon dead at Halsey. Officer Halsey decides to raise his own gun, and Lockhart shoots him. According to the killer, the officer begs not to be shot again. Lockhart will fondly recall the fear in the young cop's eyes as he fired again, then left him to bleed out. The killer now has 3 confirmed kills under his belt as he speeds off in the red Corvette as responding units close in. He manages to ditch the car, then gets into a cab, but is soon surrounded. The $100 bill he hands to the cab driver is later confirmed to be cash from a previous bank robbery, and I mentioned that in the beginning because my research is all fucked up on this case, as is the research material in my defense. That's what you get for walking through a graveyard in the Huntsville unit's Peckerwood Hill burial site. The rest is, you know, the last meal. The last words, the trial I'll get a little bit into very, very sparsely here. You might find it interesting that Michael Lockhart jumped through a 3rd-story courthouse window during jury selection in an escape attempt that saw him injured and swiftly rearrested. All this, of course, is reminiscent of Ted Bundy's much more storied, much more prolific career. But I guess maybe the crimes of Michael Lee Lockhart weren't so random after all. I think he had some inspiration here. I think he knew about Bundy. I think that he maybe idolized him in some way. And I think that many older women still alive today are quite lucky it got snuffed out when it did, this inspiration. For if it hadn't, their lives, along with their bodies, would have been cut in half as well by a so-called random killer.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.